we do not have is a tax system that attracts new investment for greater Alaska oil production.
The fight over oil tax reform gets underway at the state capitol. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 17th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a court battle over the state's troubled fast ferries.
This case has been pending a long time. It's certainly the most complex case on my docket.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
President Barack Obama laid out clear directives to Congress yesterday. He wants the legislative branch to ban the sale of high-capacity magazines and armor-piercing bullets, require background checks for all gun sales, and crack down on straw purchases of guns, sales when a legally cleared person buys a gun for someone who is legally barred from purchasing one. Joining us to talk about how the Alaska Congressional Delegation feels about this is APRN's Peter Granitz. He joins us from the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Ellen.
What's the reaction from our three members of Congress?
Well, Congressman Young put out a statement yesterday that says he's worried about regulations on what he calls aesthetically altered guns and magazines. Now, I think some people might read that to mean that it's just the look of the gun, not actually the function. He says it's easy for folks in big cities to forget the importance of guns in rural places where police aren't as prevalent and they're further away, and that a gun can be the difference between life and death. He did praise the president, though. He praised Mr. Obama for, you know, promising to investigate mental health and the relationship with guns. Senator Murkowski sent out a statement late last night. She says that the sympathy and the emotions that people are feeling right now should not cloud the Second Amendment. She thinks gun owners and gun sellers have been disrespected in the debate, but she left the door wide open. She says Congress can address the issue, and it should, but that's also the place where it could get watered down, that any kind of measure would be weakened by lobbyists and things like that. Noticeably silent was Senator Mark Begich. He did not release a statement reacting to the president's plans. He's hemmed and hawed on this issue. The one thing he has said is that he would oppose an assault weapons ban, but he hasn't said anything about background checks. He hasn't said anything about the capacity of magazines. And, you know, so long as he doesn't commit to anything, he's really not doing himself any favors. He could do really well politically to come out and say, this is exactly how I feel. I'm opposed to any new measures, but he hasn't done that yet.
So what's the delegation's relationship with the NRA?
Well, they all have A ratings, and I suppose they all have unique A ratings. It's important to note that Congressman Young actually sits on the board of directors of the NRA. He wrote an op-ed in the USA Today newspaper earlier this week on the organization's behalf. And last week, he went out to NRA headquarters out in suburban Virginia outside of Washington, D.C. to attend a meeting. And I imagine that's where they were crafting a lot of the policy that they're working on right now. The NRA endorsed Senator Murkowski over Joe Miller in the primary in 2010. Remember that contentious primary and then eventually the writing campaign. Those endorsements matter. Senator Begich has his A rating, but he didn't get it until after his race with Senator Ted Stevens. And that's not necessarily Senator Begich's fault. The group tends to lean conservative, and it's wise to always support incumbents. But they all three of them, they're proud of their A ratings, too.
So what about political contributions from the NRA?
Well, there are many organizations, including Gun Owners of America, but the big one is the National Rifle Association. That is a heavy hitter in politics. The NRA has a political action committee, and those are donations from members and to give to candidates. That political action committee, you know, we talk about PACs. That's what this is. That PAC has given Don Young $18,000 since 2008. It gave him $2,000 in 2012 alone when he really had token opposition. In 2008, when he had basically the race of his career, including a primary, it gave him $10,150. That's a lot of money in a campaign. In 2010, the NRA gave Senator Murkowski $4,500, and it has not given to Senator Begich just yet. It didn't in 2008. It supported Senator Stevens, but depending upon who his opponent is in 2014, it very well could give him something. And you know what? I think this debate that we're going to have over the next couple of months will dictate whether they decide to support him.
Anything else, Peter?
You know, there's one thing that I would note, in that a number of congressional Republicans have long complained that the president does not lead. He defers to Congress too much. He lets them take the reins, and they don't have any directive from him. But you know what? Now he is actually taking control, and the response is frustration, because he's taking control, and they're not happy with what he's doing.
APRN's Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Governor Sean Parnell hit many familiar themes during last night's State of the State address in Juneau. He advocated for a comprehensive crime bill that would levy harsher penalties on sexual predators, and he set a goal of improving Alaska's high school graduation rate from 70% to 90%. But the bulk of his speech focused on increasing energy production.
Alaska's North Slope has billions of proven barrels and billions more waiting to be discovered. What we do not have is a tax system that attracts new investment for greater Alaska oil production.
Parnell proposed to change that by setting the tax rate on oil at 25% and getting rid of a requirement that oil companies pay higher tax rates as the price of a barrel goes up. He argued that doing so would simplify the tax code and encourage oil companies to invest in Alaska instead of the lower 48. The governor also set new benchmarks for the construction of a natural gas pipeline. Democratic minority leaders expressed skepticism that Parnell's energy overhaul would increase oil production. Senate Minority Leader Johnny Ellis characterized the tax cut as a giveaway.
But if Alaska stops getting its fair share for our oil resources, it will bust our budget. And that means politicians will look to sales and income taxes and a potential raid on your PFD. That's not scare tactics. That's what's coming if this bill passes.
This is the governor's third attempt to get major oil tax changes through the legislature. The state-run company pursuing a smaller volume in-state bullet line to bring North Slope gas to Fairbanks, Anchorage, and other communities has overhauled the project. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the new plan puts the gas line on a diet.
The new in-state pipeline design calls for it to carry lean gas. Alaska Gasline Development Corporation President Dan Fowsky says that's different from the previously proposed rich stream.
The gas stream before was an enriched stream. Some people call it dirty gas, but it contained butane, ethane, all the thanes. There's a bunch of them. Ethane, for one, is used to produce plastics, and they're very valuable if there's a market for them.
Fowsky, who spoke about the revamp project in Fairbanks Wednesday, says there's no current market for the non-methane components of Alaska gas. He says refocusing on methane, the gas used for electricity generation and heating, simplifies pipeline infrastructure, including elimination of expensive stratification plants, making gas cheaper.
Because you're not doing the straddle plants and factoring those costs into the line, the tariff drops significantly.
The cost of upstream and community-specific pipeline infrastructure is reflected in the local natural gas price. Fowsky says that means under the new design, gas would be cheaper in Fairbanks than Anchorage and more than 50% less expensive than oil. Fairbanks North Star Borough Municipal Gas Utility Board member Steve Hagenson says the new gas price estimates up local appeal of the project.
The Fairbanks has a lower cost than Anchorage. A little bit of frosting that was a nice surprise, but I don't think that should be the driving factor in how we make this whole thing come together. This needs to be built, and we need to go forward. Then we can focus on one target.
The latest capital cost estimate for the Alaska standalone gas line is $7.7 billion. That's up slightly since the last estimate in 2011, a reflection of the cheaper overall design balanced against movement to a larger, more expensive 36-inch diameter pipe. A trade-off, Fowsky says, makes sense.
Just because that 36-inch pipe is readily available, the valves and all the accompanying infrastructure readily available, it's used everywhere in the world.
Fowsky says inflation increases the cost of building the 737-mile-long in-state gas line by $200 million every year the project is delayed. State legislators are considering new powers and funding for the AGDC to keep it on a timeline for completion of the pipeline by 2020. With a number of Alaska gas projects in play, Fowsky stresses we need to settle on which to advance and figure out state financing and ownership roles. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, using a byproduct of beer to fuel an Alaskan beer company.
The eventual goal is to be completely oil-free. Whether or not we ever achieve that, I don't know. We're going to get as close as we possibly can.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Federal wildlife officials today announced an agreement that could lead to the reintroduction of wood bison into Alaska. Larry Bell, a Fish and Wildlife Service Assistant Regional Director for External Affairs, says a special rule has been drafted that would designate reintroduced wood bison as non-essential experimental population, which means land the animals occupy would not be designated as critical habitat.
The proposed rule, derived from Section 10J of the Endangered Species Act, if finalized, would allow for the establishment of wood bison as an experimental population. And experimental in this sense, our requirement is that it be determined to not be essential to the continued existence of the species.
The second part of the rule, Bell says, turns management of the wood bison herd over to the Alaska Fish and Game Department. State management would include a hunting regime. Doug Vincent Lang is acting director of the State Division of Wildlife Conservation.
Yeah, they would provide subsistence resources for federally qualified and state qualified subsistence users, and as well as Alaska Natives. Once we're meeting subsistence needs, anything above and beyond that would be available for sport hunting.
Previously classified as endangered, wood bison were reclassified as threatened in May of last year under the Endangered Species Act. At present, the animals are found in the wild only in Canada, but they roamed Alaska before 1900. The state began wood bison habitat assessment efforts about 10 years ago, and in 2008 imported about 50 bison from Canada. Now more than 100 animals are kept at the Alaska Conservation Center in Portage. Plans to release the herd at Minto Flats ran into a snag a couple of years ago due to concerns that the animals' endangered status at the time could result in a habitat declaration for the area, which would have interfered with development. After today's announcement, the public will have 60 days to comment on the plan. Last month, a suspected serial killer from Washington State killed himself in a jail cell in Anchorage. Israel Keyes' suicide abruptly halted progress into uncovering one of the widest-ranging serial killing sprees in the United States. Now the FBI is trying to piece together exactly what he did. As Jessica Robinson of the Northwest News Network reports, investigators are struggling to connect seemingly random dots that they hope will lead them to other victims.
In February of 2012, Israel Keyes murdered Samantha Koenig. Keyes ordered a coffee at the stand where she worked in Anchorage, then kidnapped her, sexually assaulted her, and killed her. She was just 18. Those are the details James Koenig tries not to think about. Instead, he focuses on the little things about his daughter, Samantha.
I miss her laugh and her smile and her eyes and hearing Daddy come out of her mouth and... just one of the greatest things to hear is my name called from her voice. And that's the hardest part of my days anymore, is waking up and reliving it every day and the hopes it's a nightmare and she's going to come walking through the door any minute.
Samantha is one of three victims of Israel Keyes whose identity the FBI knows. Now agents, along with state and local law enforcement across the country, are in the midst of a needle-in-a-haystack search. They're looking for possibly eight other people that Keyes claimed to have killed in the last decade and a half. Keyes grew up in the small northeastern Washington town of Colville, and friends knew him as a father, Army veteran, and contractor. But Keyes lived, in his own words, a double life.
There is no one who knows me, or who has ever known me, who knows anything about me, really.
In interviews with the FBI after his arrest, the 34-year-old Keyes said he traveled the country kidnapping and murdering people and robbing banks to fund his sprees.
And the only person who knows about what I'm telling you, the kind of things I'm telling you, is me.
Not long after saying that, Keyes committed suicide.
This one is our murder file. Our murder file.
Rick Grobenstein is an investigator with the Washington Attorney General's office. He operates a searchable database with the details of 12,000 homicide cases in Washington. On a wall behind him is a chart of famous Washington serial killers. Ted Bundy is there, and Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer. Generally, says Grobenstein, investigations into serial murders are based on a simple premise.
People are creatures of habit. They do the same thing over and over again, so that's what you look for.
Grobenstein is now searching for four people Israel Keyes claimed to have killed in Washington. But the binder on Grobenstein's desk labeled Keyes, it's virtually empty.
Unfortunately, he didn't give us enough information to be too specific to rule out things yet, so it's a work in progress at this point.
Do you have any leads yet?
I don't know. I wish there was, but not.
Frank Harrell is the supervisory FBI agent in Eastern Washington.
What you really see here is the expression of true evil in some ways, and one that isn't possibly not explainable at all, and because there's no logical pattern. He selected seemingly at random his victims.
I ask Harrell how many missing person and unsolved homicide cases is the FBI looking into?
All of them. Literally all of them.
In an age of crowdsourcing, the case has given rise to online efforts to find Keyes' other victims. Peggy Giles of Valdez, Alaska, runs a Facebook page called Have You Ever Met Israel Keyes?
There's a lot of cases that we suspect now that the FBI hasn't said that he's involved in yet. I'm thinking 17 minimum. Just cases that fit in.
One of the details that came out of the interviews with Keyes was that his first victim was in Oregon, only he didn't kill her. Keyes said in the late 90s, he sexually assaulted a young woman along the Deschutes River near Maupin. Lane McGill is the undersheriff for Wasco County. He says they've checked through years of handwritten logs and computer records and haven't found anything.
If it got reported, we would have a record of it. I mean, we don't take those kind of cases lightly here, that's for sure. I think that we've either have a victim out there that did not report it, or it actually didn't happen.
I talked to other people in law enforcement who raised the same question. Was Keyes telling the truth about his murders, or was he embellishing, as some killers do? Still, the FBI says other details, like which banks Keyes said he robbed, did check out. Either way, Samantha Koenig's father, James, hopes investigators will figure it out soon for the sake of the victims' families.
You have to get the answers so you can rest somewhat. That's the main thing, is get them home one way or another, so you can either hug them or lay them to rest properly.
The FBI is now asking the public for any information they might have about Israel Keyes. I'm Jessica Robinson, reporting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The state's Fast Ferry lawsuit is underway again. There have been delays and bumps along the way in the complicated two-year-old case, including the principal builder of the vessels being dropped from the lawsuit. But now the case appears headed for trial in April. KTOO's Matt Miller has the latest from Juneau.
It's full steam ahead for a lawsuit over alleged defects in the high-performance diesel engines for the state's Fast Ferries. State attorneys say they've deposed some potential witnesses and received documents relevant to the case as part of the discovery process, but they're still anxious about other key documents apparently still missing as the early April trial date approaches. The state of Alaska and the Alaska Marine Highway System are suing the company that made the allegedly defective engines for the Fast Ferries Fairweather and Chinigo. The Fast Ferry's engines were built by German company MTU Friedrichshafen. American company MTU Detroit Diesel, now renamed as Tognum America, which maintained the engines, is also named as a defendant in the suit. Judge Philip Hallenberg has been assigned to the case. A pretrial status hearing was held in Juneau Superior Court.
This case has been pending a long time. It's certainly the most complex case on my docket.
Senior Assistant Attorney General Dana Burke is lead attorney in the team representing the state of Alaska and the Alaska Marine Highway System. He wants to stick to the predetermined trial date to arrange for witness travel and other trial logistics. But as the discovery process wraps up, Burke says he's still waiting for the production of key documents.
Test results from the blown engine of the Fairweather from 2004. We have deposed several MTU witnesses who said there was basically a full autopsy on that engine. It would have likely included photographs, data, notes. For all we know, computer information. These engines come with their own computer information storage technology.
Burke also wants complete records related to MTU's contract to provide the engines to Director Shipyard, the company that built the ferries. They include purchase orders that may contain warranty disclaimers passed on from the manufacturer to the immediate purchaser of the engines, but not on to the remote purchaser or the eventual consumer of the engines, which is the state ferry system in this case. Judge Pallenberg signaled that it may become a pivotal issue in this case and a new issue never before considered by Alaska courts.
And so if the manufacturer's limitation attempt to limit its liability depends on the happenstance of whether somebody outside the manufacturer's control passes the disclaimers on to the next person in the chain, that might be contrary to the policies behind the Morrow holding. Some states have held otherwise. It's a question of first impression. I said that's an argument that can be made. I'm not saying it's an argument I would accept, but I think it's an open question of law.
Retired Judge Douglas Serdaley, who currently specializes in environmental and antitrust issues in his Anchorage-based practice, is now representing MTU. Serdaley says keeping the April trial date is important for them as well.
Like the state, we will have witnesses traveling here to the trial, perhaps some from Germany and some from around the country. So we appreciate the courts holding that time frame open for us.
Another member of MTU's legal team says documents previously requested by the state of Alaska are being produced. The Connecticut company that built the ferries, Director Shipyard, filed for bankruptcy protection last January and is not currently part of the lawsuit. The early April trial is expected to run at least 3 weeks. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Most people only drink green beer on St. Patrick's Day, but next time you tip a bottle of amber, pale, or IPA from Juneau's Alaskan Brewing Company, that's exactly what you'll be drinking. Green beer, as in good for the environment. Alaskan has cut its oil consumption by nearly 70% after installing a new grain-fired steam boiler, which burns spent barley used in the brewing process. KTOO's Casey Kelly takes a look at how it works.
Alaskan Brewing Company engineer Brandon Smith stands in the brew house as members of the brew crew shuttle back and forth pouring ingredients into large mixing tanks.
So where we are right now, we're on the brew deck. That's what we call the place where we actually do the first part of the brewing process. We'll go over here and get out of Chaz's way.
As any good home brewer can tell you, the basic beer ingredients are water, barley, hops, and yeast. While the finished product is best enjoyed cold, making beer involves a lot of heat. Malted barley is combined with hot water in a process called mashing. After various temperature increases, the barley water mixture, or wort, is brought to a boil.
We have to boil it, we have to cool it down, we have to move heat from one place to another. It takes a tremendous amount of energy.
As of late last year, Smith says Alaskan is using spent grain from the brewing process as the sole source of heat for making more beer. When the company started in 1986, burning oil was the only heat source. In the mid-90s, Smith says Alaskan began burning some spent grain, but not for making beer.
Since we put in this large brew house in 1995, we have been burning some of our spent grain to generate hot gases to dry more spent grain.
Some lower 48 breweries give away used grain to farmers for cattle feed, but with no farms in Juneau, Smith says Alaskan started drying its spent grain to make it easier to ship down south. Then a mash filter press installed in 2008 produced an even drier spent grain product, resulting in about a 30% decrease in the brewery's oil consumption. But Smith says the company didn't want to stop there, wanting to recapture as much of the byproduct as possible for use in the brewing process.
It's kind of like a coarse flour. It's very dry, burns pretty well. The trick is that burning spent grain isn't like burning sawdust or any other traditional fuel.
So Alaskan ordered a custom-built steam boiler, which burns the grain at about 1,600 degrees Fahrenheit. After a few months of tweaking, it finally came online in late 2012. With a price tag of $1.8 million, it didn't come cheap, but Smith estimates a 65 to 70% reduction in oil use, or about 150,000 gallons a year.
We expect further gains in that percentage by creating other efficiencies in the operation. The eventual goal is to be completely oil-free. Whether or not we ever achieve that, I don't know. We're going to get as close as we possibly can.
Julia Herz is the craft beer program director with the industry group Brewers Association. She says it's not unusual for small breweries to reuse materials as much as possible. In fact, Herz says it's ingrained in the business model of craft beer.
The small brewers can experiment in very creative ways, and that's what's exciting as a beer lover, frankly, to watch as these breweries dip their toe into the business world as much as the innovation world in beer styles.
In addition to cutting its oil consumption, the new boiler means Alaskan is no longer shipping grain to the lower 48. That's yet another cost-saving measure, and as Smith points out, it too is reducing the company's carbon footprint.
From a corporate sustainability standpoint, we want to make as much use of the materials we have as we can. And so keeping that material here in Juneau, keeping that much oil out of Juneau, and not having to burn that fossil fuel is a big advantage for everyone.
And many in the capital city and around Alaska may want to raise a glass to green beer. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jessica Robinson in Washington State, and Matt Miller and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.